for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. NATO pledges 7,000 troops in support of President Obama's new strategy for the war in Afghanistan. A suicide bomb attack at a mosque in Pakistan today leaves dozens dead, including many army officials. And Iran says it will produce a higher grade of nuclear fuel on its own. Joining me for the international portion of our Friday news roundup, James Kitfield of the National Journal, Barbara Slavin of the Washington Times, and Abdelrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
I'd be interested in your reaction to the fact that NATO has come through and pledged really more than was expected, 7,000 troops to the coalition in Afghanistan. Why did that happen, James Kitfield? And will it be enough for President Obama's plans?
Well, it happened because Europe has been very nervous. This long, drawn-out deliberation that's taken 3 months made the Europeans pretty nervous about our intentions in Afghanistan. You know, NATO has put its credibility on the line. NATO is even more important to the Europeans than it is to us because it is the glue that holds their security together. So NATO can't really afford to have a defeat right now in Afghanistan. So I think they felt like they would have to step up to the plate. I've talked to some administration officials this week. It was clear they had those pledges in their pocket before he made a speech. So that's why they did it. And I think that he'll have, you know, it's interesting, a lot more support in Europe and in NATO for what he said on Tuesday night than really in his own party.
How interesting. So that even though General McChrystal had asked for 40,000 troops and President Obama came up with 30,000, you're saying that the administration knew beforehand they were going to get a hefty amount from NATO.
Absolutely. And they've, you know, in the testimony yesterday, Secretary Gates said there's probably 3,000 extra in that number who will be support troops. So you're at 40,000. McChrystal got what he wanted.
And what about the fight over exit strategy, Barbara?
Well, in terms of whether there is one, you know, we've seen a lot of ambiguous kind of wishy-washy comments from administration officials on Capitol Hill this week. So, you know, on the one hand, they say that July 2011 is the beginning of a process, an inflection point, as Secretary Gates put it, of transition. On the other hand, we hear that, you know, the pace of withdrawal will be determined by conditions on the ground. So I think this is what Obama hopes he will be able to do. He wants to concentrate the minds of the Afghans. But there is no assurance that Afghanistan will be ready for a U.S. withdrawal. We really don't know how much advance Afghanistan is going to make in terms of the capability of its own troops. We had a reporter and a photographer in Helmand last month embedded in a striker brigade, and they saw zero Afghan troops basically fighting alongside the Americans. So I think there's a danger that when you send in more foreigners, that it makes it even easier for the Afghans to take a back seat. I don't know how they train them up and put them in a position where they really will have to be doing some of the fighting on their own.
And how long might that day take, Abdelrahim?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people who listened to the speech in the region, there was something good about it and there was something not so good about it. The good thing about it was that it didn't have, in the view of a lot of people in the Middle East, any of the gung-ho cowboy ingredients that the Bush speeches used to have about such topics as Iraq and Afghanistan and so on and so forth. But what's not so good about it is that for a man who actually, and I mean President Barack Obama, who went to Cairo a few months ago, and he told the Muslim world, look, America has no bad designs vis-a-vis the Muslim world. We're not conquerors. We don't have any colonial designs. And now he's saying he's sending 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. His intentions may be the best in the world. But down there in the region, his speech is viewed with a lot of skepticism, not just about sending additional troops, but about when the U.S. may actually be able to leave Afghanistan or not.
And we've just gotten a report from the Associated Press that U.S. Marines and Afghan troops launched today the first offensive since President Barack Obama announced an American troop surge, striking against Taliban communications supply lines in a southern insurgent stronghold. So the process begins, James.
Yeah, and I'd like to make a point about this exit strategy. I mean, the template here, and it shouldn't surprise any of us, the template is Iraq. It's a five-year template. They expect, just like they did in Iraq, to buy enough goodness in the next 18 months, year to 18 months. McChrystal has put that timeline on himself, that he had to turn the situation around in a year to 18 months, at which point, as we saw in Iraq, you can start probably drawing down the surge part of your presence in Afghanistan. And then if that goodness continues, you can then start to pull out troops. Just like in Iraq, we're 3 years into the surge in Iraq. We're now going to pull out almost all of our troops by the end of 2011. That's a five-year window. Admiral Mullen told me this very specifically. That's what they have in mind. And the key is that they buy enough goodness, that this works enough that the pressure in 18 months is, hey, we're making progress. We're pulling in the background as the Afghans pull forward. There's fewer American casualties. And then it becomes politically much more feasible.
If the template is Iraq, and I do believe that it is, then obviously there's a big problem, because the outcome of Iraq, even at the present time, is being expressed in the region through various degrees of pessimism. Now, the most extreme point of that pessimism would have it that Iraq is actually even now a failed state. The only difference between Iraq, people who hold that view, and a country like Somalia, for example, is that Iraq is rich in resources, oil, and so on and so forth. Now, bear in mind that Iraq is not only the cradle of human civilization, it's the cradle of the notion of a strong state. Thousands of years. The Afghans have not had that for a very, very, very long time. Now, any talk about transitioning control, as the president said in his speech, to the Afghans has to be seen through that prism. The Afghans may not, for a very long time to come indeed, be able to hold the country together without the Americans.
Yeah, the quality of the Afghan forces, there are about 90,000 or so in the Afghan army. Most of them are illiterate. They don't have any kind of understanding of military structures. They need absolutely the most basic training, and they tend not to show up for missions again, according to our reporters. This, unlike Iraq, which has this martial tradition, as Abdurrahim pointed out, that goes back thousands of years and had fought a number of wars under Saddam Hussein, and had a very strong army. It was the only unifying force within Iraq. Afghanistan has none of that. It has tribal warlords. It has ethnic divisions that have, really separated the country to an enormous extent. And it's going to be quite a project.
And now President Karzai said in an interview yesterday he's willing to talk with Taliban leaders, chiefs. What is the aim of doing that? Is it, as Abdurrahim has said, the Iraq template, which is paying off individuals to come to our side?
Absolutely. It's the Anbar model applied to Afghanistan. And, Secretary Clinton said just yesterday, one of the key goals, and it gets to your point, that it's going to be a more decentralized state that we leave than Iraq. That's clear. But they're going to make deals with tribal leaders and sheiks and shuras all through the country, and to put those guys, put their militias on the payroll, as we did in Iraq, to try to get them off the fence or off the side of the Taliban. That worked pretty well. Then we put the payroll onto the Afghans, just like we did in Iraq, and you hope that that sticks. But clearly that is part of the strategy. And again, it is the Iraq template. These guys, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that General Petraeus and General McChrystal, who were two of the top guys in Iraq, and that surge was probably the most successful U.S. military victory since Incheon landing in the Korean War. That is the narrative in the military now. They think they know how to do this now, and it should surprise no one that Iraq is the template for what they're going to try to do in the surge in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, we have to talk about Pakistan, though, because that's where the Taliban leadership is based. We had a story just a couple weeks ago saying that Mullah Omar, the leader of the Afghan Taliban, is actually in Karachi under the protection of the Pakistani intelligence agency. Many of the other leaders are in Balochistan, in the city of Quetta, across the border from Afghanistan. So even if this great strategy works, what do you do about the other component? Now, you had that to some extent in Iraq. You had Baathists coming in from Syria, and you had the support from Iran for Shia special groups and so on. But this is an even more graphic example of sanctuary on the other side. And the Pakistani part is pretty wobbly.
And, of course, the Pakistanis continued to deny that Osama bin Laden is anywhere around.
Or Mullah Omar. They say, show us the intelligence. You know, where are they? We'll go and get them. But there's a certain lack of trust there.
Actually, just yesterday, I spoke to Admiral Mike Mullen, and he was still, as the administration has been adamant that bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri and all the others are in that border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Abderrahim Fukara is Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, more of our conversation, and you join in. Welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Barbara Slavin at the Washington Times, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, and Abderrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Today, a mosque, Barbara, that served Pakistani military was attacked during Friday prayers. Who's doing this? And with the attacks increasing, has the Pakistani army made any progress in their fight against insurgents?
Well, it's a reaction to what the Pakistani army has already done over the last few months. You remember that the Pakistani Taliban had taken over Swat. They were within 100 kilometers of Islamabad. They got rolled back by the Pakistani army, which then started an offensive in South Waziristan in the area along the border with Afghanistan. So this is retaliation by the Pakistani Taliban in conjunction with al-Qaeda. It's a kind of blowback. The militant groups that became the Pakistani Taliban were created by the Pakistani intelligence agencies to fight India back starting in the 1980s. And so they are showing their displeasure with what is seen as a U.S. Orchestrated campaign against Islamic militants in Pakistan.
And Barbara earlier said that, you know, the part of the Afghan situation that you can't control totally is Pakistan. That's correct. But we have done a lot to try to get Pakistan on our side of this fight. General Jones, who is the National Security Advisor, was over there in the last week, really offering a strategic partnership that goes well beyond this situation, that includes a lot of economic development, but they have to get off the dime and quit supporting these extremist groups. And actually, I think this, you know, these extremist groups are their own worst enemy, just like we saw with al-Qaeda in Iraq. When they start bombing mosques and killing Muslims, that tends to lose a lot of public support. And hopefully that will happen here, because I don't think it gains them a lot of friends in Pakistan to be bombing mosques.
And of course, President Obama singled out Pakistan in his speech, which was not received very happily in Pakistan. Abderrahi.
Absolutely. I mean, if I may, first of all, say one thing about the speech. Obviously, the main target for the speech was the home audience here in the United States. But the various administration officials that the Obama administration funneled out that evening to speak to the foreign media, including us, Al Jazeera, clearly indicated that they also have a lot of interest riding on the foreign audience in that part of the world. The timing, though, was not particularly helpful. It was 8 o'clock Eastern here in the United States, 3, 4 o'clock in the region. Who's watching? So that's one thing. Obviously, Pakistan is very important in any strategy, as President Obama outlined it. The problem that the Pakistani government has, and Pakistani government, it seems to me, is in a bind. Granted, the Obama administration has been saying that popular support has been increasing in Pakistan for the Pakistani government. But the closer the United States holds the Pakistani government, the more alienated the Pakistani government becomes from Pakistani public opinion. It's just the dynamics of anti-American sentiment in that region. It has just become mantra that the closer the United States holds the government to it, the more alienated the Pakistani government becomes from the Pakistanis.
So how to deal with that? How to deal with that?
Well, you start by making any support you do not very transparent. And a lot of we have special forces in Pakistan who are training Pakistan Frontier Corps. We have this drone operation that includes U.S. people on the ground. You never see them. It's very secretive because it's just so controversial in that country. You know, but Pakistan's kind of funny. As soon as you say you're going to leave Afghanistan, they start freaking out. Oh, please don't leave. As soon as you say you're going to surge, don't surge. You'll drive the militants back. I mean, they will accept your help and at the same time resent you for it in the same breath. It's a difficult country to deal with.
I want to say one quick thing. If and this is about President Obama and President Karzai, just as a follow-up to what just has been said now. If I were not a journalist, meaning if I could allow myself to express personal sentiment as a journalist, I would say that I truly feel very sorry for both President Obama and Karzai, because they both inherited impossible situations. Have Karzai, for example, been accused of corruption? Well, what do you expect? I mean, the conditions under which he was put at the top of the government in Afghanistan a few years ago, you would not expect anything else. And now we're talking about paying off the Taliban. The U.S. government is talking about paying off. So how do you fight corruption? For President Obama, this is just something that he inherited. I personally do not see a good outcome at the end of the line for his strategy.
And it's very interesting because the President, General McChrystal, those in charge are sending U.S. troops into the most dangerous parts of Afghanistan, Barbara.
Yeah, they're sending them to Helmand, which is the most difficult area. Again, this question of whether you can buy loyalty, whether that's going to be possible. Mm. When you start announcing exit dates or targets, immediately people want to hedge. It's going to be very difficult.
All right. I'm going to open the phones and take some calls on these very issues. first to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane, and to your guest. What a mess. This new surge that we're going to do with NATO, I'm just curious how the NATO alliance is going to respond. And I have to rename NATO instead of NATO. It's going to be the newest Afghani Teutonic oppressors. I don't understand what's going on over there as far as, here it is, Christian countries with NATO. I mean, all the NATO countries now are Christian, and they're going to be sending all these white guys over there to, take on the Muslim countries, and I can't understand what the Muslim countries, how they cannot respond in kind as far as the Crusaders are coming again.
Foreign troops are always a very controversial thing on foreign soil. I will point out that in every poll, still to this day, the majority of Afghans support the international troop presence in their country. And they do that because they have seen the Taliban. They have lived under the Taliban. It wasn't a very pleasant experience for them. That girls couldn't go to school. It was a very medieval sort of view of the world, and they didn't flourish under that. So what really worries them is this insecurity. They feel like they get shaken down at Taliban roadblocks. So I think that, yes, it is controversial. You'd rather not have foreign troops in your soil, but if they're seen as supplying security for you, it's probably better them than the Taliban.
Yeah, just wanted to remind the caller that Turkey is in NATO and Turkey is a Muslim country, so they're not all Christian crusaders.
We were talking yesterday with Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea, about his beginning to help young girls have schools, have teachers, and now again the Taliban closing down those schools.
Well, I mean, I wanted to extrapolate from what you said about Afghanistan to the rest of the Muslim world. Not everybody, obviously, in the Muslim world supports the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and that's probably the silver lining for what President Obama is trying to do in that part of the world. But to go back to the issue of NATO, what would obviously have been completely revolutionary for the Obama administration is if it managed to get Muslim troops into Afghanistan. But what are the chances that the Obama administration would even think about asking Muslim governments to supply troops to go to Afghanistan? That's just not going to happen.
All right. To Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi there, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is about media coverage of the Afghan war. Specifically, I don't know if this is because of the media I watch, but I tend to see more coverage of explosions, things like that, than sort of the human face of Afghanistan. And I wonder what the reasons are for that. If it's, part of it seems to be that it's very dangerous for journalists to cover it, but also it might be, some actions on the part of the administration, for example, embedding journalists comes to mind to portray a certain image of the war. So I wanted to get the guest's comments on media coverage.
Sure. Dan, let me ask you a question. When you say you'd like to see more of the human face of war, what exactly do you mean?
More interviews with the Afghani people, more maybe coverage of the differences within the country. It's obviously a country that varies regionally.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling up, Iraq.
Well, I mean, it's just the classic case of war coverage, particularly if I may say in this country where the coverage tends to shy away from being graphic in its depiction of what actually goes on the front line. The assumption in this country is that public opinion would turn against you if you showed one of the faces of war, which is the gore that generally goes with fighting. But I do agree that people around the world, not just in the United States, do not actually have enough information about the composition and the complexity of the social and political fabric of a place like Afghanistan.
Now, of course, you've got people like Martha Raddatz of ABC, who, when she does go to Afghanistan, is primarily embedded with the troops. And that is part of the problem, is it not, Barbara? You've been there many times.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a variety of different stories one can do. You know, my paper sent someone for 6 weeks in the summer of 2008 to just talk to Afghans. We sent her back to be embedded with the military the last month because Obama was making his decision about whether to send more troops, and it seemed appropriate to hear what U.S. forces on the ground were saying about what they needed and wanted during that period. But I think we make the efforts we do. One problem, of course, is that it's just very expensive,
of course,
to send people. And, of course, everyone knows what the situation of American journalism and foreign correspondence is in right now.
James.
I think there's a couple of dynamics. Going. I mean, even domestic coverage, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, what's going wrong with the violence, whatever goes wrong in society is usually what you put your focus on in media. When you're covering a war, it's obvious that you cover your own troops in that war. So that's another inclination of the American media. Security situation is also important. It's hard to get out and talk to the Afghans when your life would be threatened at every roadblock. So there are it doesn't really an excuse. We need to do more of that coverage, but it's hard to get.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about Iran. Abdirahim, outline what happened this week about Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Well, several things. One of the most important of which is that the Iranian government has decided to harden up its rhetoric following the decision taken in Vienna by the United Nations, the IAEA. The second thing is that the world is obviously watching Iran very closely, watching what the United States is trying to do in terms of convincing the Russians and the Chinese to change their tack on the issue of any possible sanctions on Iran in the future. And the third thing is the world is watching Iran while getting ready for December 7th, which is the anniversary of the 1953 CIA-induced coup to restore the Shah of Iran, the coup that toppled a democratically elected government. So all these things are concocting in a very interesting story and getting the Iranian government to behave in a certain way.
Barbara, what's the significance of this 20% fuel that Iran is talking about?
I think people have to understand that when Ahmadinejad speaks, a lot of it is bombast and bluster. You know, on Sunday he said Iran would build 10 more uranium enrichment plants. Well, Iran hasn't been able to complete two that we know of. And one of them actually has half its centrifuges, apparently not operable. He said that Iran would enrich its uranium from 3.5% uranium-235, which is the isotope that's so explosive, to 20%. Well, again, Iran has a stockpile of uranium enriched to 3.5%. We're not sure how long it would take to enrich it to 30%, and then they can't make the fuel rods that they need. Remember the deal they agreed to. They were going to send out their uranium. They were going to process it in Russia and France, send it back, put it in a reactor that the U.S. provided, by the way, to make medical isotopes. I don't know that Iran can make the fuel rods for this. So a lot of this is bluster. Iran is in an complex situation right now. Internally, the dissent is continuing, increasing. Abdirahim mentioned Monday. Monday is National Students' Day. It's the anniversary of the killing of three students at Tehran University in 1953. They were protesting the reinstallation of the Shah by the CIA. And there will be demonstrations throughout Iran on campuses, despite the fact that there's been a massive crackdown and a roundup of student activists over the last 3 weeks.
So, bombast, James?
Yeah, it was interesting. And I actually was curious, you know, after the elections, the fiasco that they had in the summer, and they've obviously the government sits very uneasy on its throne right now. And there was a question in my mind whether they would become a little bit more accommodating to the international community so they could focus inward on their internal problems, or whether they would sort of up the level of bombast and sort of hunker down. I think what we're seeing now is they're going to up the level of bombast and hunker down, which means that the ball is now in the Obama administration's court. Can you, as has been said, get Russia and China to support the next step in sanctions? Because if you can't, the Obama administration's kind of at a crossroads itself, because it doesn't have any plan Bs. And Israeli is tapping it on the shoulder constantly and saying, if something better be done, because we cannot allow them to have a nuclear weapon, and they may get one within a year.
And what is Iran doing with its navy?
They're doing what they always do, which is they actually had started some patrols, anti-piracy patrols in the Gulf of Aden. But, you know, whenever they ratchet up the bombast, they tend to do these exercises that show that they could stop the oil flow through the straits there. And they know that scares a lot of people.
And finally, before our break, tell us about what's happening in Somalia, Abdirrahim.
Well, I mean, Somalia obviously has been in turmoil since 1991 when the government of Ziad Barre came to an end. There's never been any stability. That was topped over the past few days with that bombing that basically killed three ministers in a government that doesn't seem to control an awful lot of even the capital, Mogadishu.
Who's responsible for that bombing?
Well, the government is saying that the Shabab Mujahideen are responsible for it. The Shabab Mujahideen are saying that the government is responsible for it, and saying that the police chief had got word that he was going to get sacked, and therefore he resorted to that as a countermeasure.
And on Monday, we'll do an entire hour on Somalia.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Eugene Hoots, leader of the band Gogo Bordello. Their inspiration, traditional gypsy music.
It's probably the most passionate, the most flamboyant, the most merry and gay music that there was before rock and roll.
The punk gypsy sound of Gogo Bordello on the next Fresh Air.
And let's go right to the phones in our international hour of the Friday News Roundup to Greg, who's in Burlington, North Carolina. Good morning to you. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Good morning. I just have two quick questions
sure.
from the gentleman from Al Jazeera. NATO has Turkey as one of its members. Does Turkey have any troops going to Afghanistan? That's my first part. My second part is, in the Arab world, Arabs are killing Arabs. Are there any Arab/Muslim countries giving any military, economic, or civilian aid to the crisis in Afghanistan?
Abdirrahim.
I don't know how the Turks are going to handle this one. I mean, they have they have found ways to deal with similar issues in the past. In this particular one, I don't know at this particular point in time. I know that someone has been arguing in the American press, I think someone in Newsweek, that basically the woes of the United States in that part of the world have actually served Turkey ultimately. And you've seen the Turks being very active on the Iranian front, on the Palestinian front with Israel and so on and so forth. So the Turks may feel strong enough at this particular point in time to think about how they could contribute to a NATO force in Afghanistan. I'm not sure about that. But I know there are other Arab countries that are involved in Afghanistan in various ways. Saudi Arabia has always had a role of one kind or another in Afghanistan. The United Arab Emirates, there's a lot of money flowing into Afghanistan, some of it for reconstruction, some of it for other purposes.
The Prime Minister of Turkey is going to be in Washington next week. I wouldn't be surprised. They have had troops in fact, they had the NATO lead there for a while, a few years back. So it wouldn't be a huge surprise if Turkey, you know, coughed up some troops for this surge. We'll know in a few days, probably.
Let's take a caller in Ottawa, Canada. Good morning, Ryan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to raise an issue. In Canada this week, obviously, we've been following President Obama's Afghan decision very closely. And there, I must say, there was a bit of a brouhaha here on Monday when President Obama was calling foreign leaders to indicate to them what the new strategy would be. And one of the leaders on the list was not Prime Minister Stephen Harper, which to a lot of Canadians was slightly offensive, given that Canada has suffered the highest number of casualties, and we have 3,000 troops that are in combat in Kandahar, one of the most dangerous parts of Afghanistan. So in terms of a broader question, although President Obama is doubling down in Afghanistan starting in the ninth year now, do you think the allies will be there much longer going forward, say, after the sort of initial strategy is rolled out? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling, sir. Barbara.
Well, as the caller well knows, Canada has said it will withdraw its troops in 2011. And so I'm sure there is a question about whether it could be asked to extend them. With the U.S. saying it's going to start withdrawing, that would seem a little doubtful. I wanted to add one more thing about Turkey, though. For the previous caller, Turkey has been very involved in construction and reconstruction in Afghanistan. It's built a lot of schools, a lot of clinics, and so and they did take the lead of the International Security Assistance Forces, as James pointed out. So they have been very involved. I don't know if there are any other Muslim countries that might be willing to make contributions there. But yeah, maybe Obama didn't call Harper because Canada said it's going to withdraw in 2 years.
James.
I suppose that's possible. It would seem a little bit more of the body language the Bush administration used to do, you know, sort of ostracizing people who weren't seen as very helpful. I doubt that was the reason. And, you know, he's a very busy guy right before this speech, so maybe it was overlooked. I can assure you that no one has overlooked the contribution Canada's made. They have been in the South, where it's been the worst fighting for a number of years. Everyone appreciates they've had some of the highest casualty rates of NATO. So everyone appreciates that Canada has been very, very, very supportive of this. They say they're leaving. That's not particularly helpful. I think the Obama administration would prefer that they say they will keep some level. And I think this is a clear indication that NATO is sticking. We've got 40,000 NATO troops there. They're going to plus that up to almost 50,000. That is a signal that they understand that the alliance has bet its credibility on Afghanistan, and the alliance is more important to them than Afghanistan and their relationship with the United States. So I think NATO is sticking.
All right. To Denver, Colorado. Good morning, Saft.
Good morning. I have a two-part question.
Sure.
The first one is, how could we possibly make any dent in the AFPAC strategy without having the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, falling in line? And the second question is, just as somebody alluded to Turkey's role, even India is involved in reconstruction of Afghanistan.
Yes. Yes.
But yet I see in the media and even in the political circles somehow putting up the moral equivalence between India's efforts to reconstruction in Afghanistan and Pakistan's support to Taliban. I mean, how do the two even have an equivalent?
Soft, I'm glad you called. Barbara?
Yeah, well, the caller points out a very important dynamic that we haven't discussed about Afghanistan, namely that it is still the epicenter of proxy fights between the neighbors. India is very active in terms of construction and so on. Pakistan doesn't like this. And, of course, there have been bombings against the Indian embassy, other Indian targets in Afghanistan, one of the reasons that Pakistan created the Taliban to begin with in the early 90s was so that Pakistan would control Afghanistan and not India. And it's, you know, you could say that without resolving the issue of Kashmir, you're not going to resolve the problems of Afghanistan, because that's certainly one of the underlying factors. You pointed out about the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, plays a double game, always has, wants U.S. support, but at the same time funnels support to groups that are opposing U.S. forces. And as long as the U.S. says that it's not going to be in Afghanistan forever, then the ISI is going to continue to do that.
All right. Caller in Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Edward.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I have a question for either one of your guests.
Sure.
I watch all the Monday, Sunday morning news commentary shows and the news footage every day. And I have a question that never seems to be discussed or answered, and that is, I'm a retired military person, so I know the cost of such things. The insurgents and who we're fighting in Afghanistan is all Russian-made equipment, Russian RPGs, Russian weapons, ammunition. How has anybody discussed, are we at war with Russia behind the scenes, or has anyone asked who is actually funding this? The money is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, and somebody has got to be paying for this. I mean,
James Kitfield.
No, I don't think the Russians are supporting this. The Russians are because of Chechnya, are very, very concerned about Islamic extremism growing on its southern border. And they've been pretty supportive of even us allowing use their airspace for logistics reasons for this. I don't think this region, because of the Soviet occupation, because of the Civil War, is awash in weapons of all types. So that would be point one. Point two, the money's coming primarily from the drug trade and also from the Persian Gulf. And I think we have someone here who probably could comment on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. There's money coming primarily from places like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, although I'm not exactly in a position to say exactly where that money is going. It is said that part of it is going to reconstruction, but the country is obviously awash in Gulf money.
All right, but that caller leads us to our question about Russian President Vladimir Putin. What did he tell a television audience yesterday, James?
Well, he wants to be president again, apparently. He's currently the prime minister, but when he stepped aside, he had a hand-picked successor. Russian constitution keeps you from running for president in three consecutive terms. He filled two, so now he has to take a breather. But he said this last week that he might well run for president again in 2012, at which the current president, Medvedev, said, well, sort of bring it on. I might run as well. What I think we're seeing here is we've always wondered whether sort of Medvedev was sort of a puppet and Putin was still the power behind the throne. I think we're starting to see that they're competing powers in a way. There was a speech that Medvedev gave in recent weeks where he really sort of lambasted these recent elections that were just a fraud. And it was his own party he was lambasting, saying, you know, we have to sort of have real free elections. It's the modern way. You know, we got to stop some of the old ways. A lot of people saw that as a shot across Putin's bow because he is the old guard. Things could get kind of interesting in Russia.
All right. And to Chappell in Indianapolis. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. I had a question about the Afghan security forces or Afghan military, you want to call them. You guys had a guest on. It was an author about the ethnic groups in Afghanistan. And I was led to believe that the third largest ethnic group makes up most of the military and the military officers. And then you have the Pashtuns, which is the largest ethnic group, refused to join the military because of this reason. I just had a question about how the U.S. plans to deal with that. And
Barbara.
Yeah, the caller is correct. I think most of the officers are Hazaras and Tajiks. They're Shia Muslim. They've traditionally been friendlier to the United States. They opposed the Taliban during the civil wars in Afghanistan in the 1990s, and the majority is Pashtun, and they form most of the Taliban. And again, you know, how are you going to be able to get these people to come into a force that's commanded by another ethnic group? They even speak different languages. There's the Pashto language, and then there's the Dari language, which is spoken by many of the Shia Muslims. So it's it's, you know, at least in Iraq you had one tongue, Arabic, and a history of working together in the Iraqi army.
I think that's one of the that was the conundrum that President Obama faced over the election in Afghanistan, because Hamid Karzai is obviously Pashtun. He represents the majority tribe, but they knew that there was corruption and there was fraud in the election. But on the other hand, there was Abdullah, who is a Tajik. There's a lot of support for him in the army, but in the wider circles of Afghan society, obviously didn't call a lot of the shots.
Again, I keep going back to the Iraq template because I think it's what the military is looking at. The way they had the same problem in Iraq with the Sunnis not joining the Iraqi security forces, and they reached these deals with the militias and the Sons of Iraq. I think they're going to try to do the same thing with Pashtun militias down south. Mm-hmm. And, it raises an issue. I know they're trying very hard to try to get more Pashtuns into the military, but they're going to have to up the money and do all these things. But I think it's the militias, the short-term answer to this problem.
All right. To Holly, New York. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning. My question is perhaps naive, but I'm having a hard time understanding the recent attack in Pakistan at the mosque. I don't understand how allegedly a religious fundamentalist can attack a house of worship and slaughter people who are generally in the same faith. I'm really having a hard time understanding that, and I was hoping that your guest could enlighten me.
I have just as much of a hard time trying to understand that. And I mean, in the same situation that we talked about in Somalia, you get various people accusing others of doing that. You have the government saying that, you know, the rebels have an axe to grind, and they have every reason to commit those crimes. And then you have the rebels saying, no, it's actually the government that has an interest in basically whipping up public opinion against us. So they use their secret intelligence to commit those bombings. At the end of the day, you never know who's actually behind those bombings.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Did you want to add to that, James?
I was just going to say, I mean, there's been a big debate within al-Qaeda itself. There was during when Zarqawi was killing a lot of Shias. You know, al-Qaeda is a Sunni group, killing a lot of Shias to try to start a civil war. Zawahiri sort of wrote a tract saying, though, you can't kill the faithful, but if you define them as apostates because they are not as fundamentalist as you, then you can kill them and you can get someone to issue a fatwa. But again, they're their own worst enemies, and thankfully so, because this really decreases their support in the public.
And finally, to Akron, Ohio. Good morning, Sai. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. My question's for the Al Jazeera gentleman. Given that many polls say that the Americans are overwhelmingly opposed to the war in Afghanistan, could you comment on the fact that Karzai is financially connected to Chevron, that China is benefiting by its two foes, the Muslims and the Americans, fighting each other, that only one in 35 provinces in Afghanistan is controlled by the Americans, there are reports of the CIA being involved in the poppy trade, and so forth.
All right. James, do you want to start with that global view?
That wrapped up almost all the conspiracy theories I've heard in the region. I really don't have a whole lot to add to that. I mean, I know we control more than one province, that's for sure, but a lot of those figures I'm really not familiar with.
Barbara?
Yeah, clearly the Chinese are benefiting financially, and they're not sending any troops. And, you know, the U.S. Throws treasure into wars, and China just keeps on rolling up the world economy. But I don't think it's a conspiracy.
It was
clever policy.
It was my understanding that 51% of Americans supported Mr. Obama's move on Afghanistan. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's the latest polls. You know, people are willing to give this a little bit longer. As Obama pointed out, this is where the 9/11 attackers came from. But I think the president understands that patience is limited.
And what happens in Iraq meantime?
Well, they obviously have this big debate about whether the election is going to happen on target in January or not. And in many ways, the President Obama's strategy to get out of Iraq obviously rides on that decision, on the decision of whether the election is going to happen in January. If it doesn't happen in January, if it happens in March, as a lot of people seem to be saying now, because of the veto of the vice president, who says that the Sunnis do not have enough representation because of a lot of Iraqis who left Iraq after the invasion are actually Sunni. If it doesn't happen in January, then I would imagine it would have implications for the U.S. getting troops from Iraq to Afghanistan.
Abdirahim Fukara. He's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Barbara Slavin, she's at the Washington Times. James Kitfield, he's with National Journal Magazine. With all these problems on the horizon, the world stage, have a good weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.